All right. So we had a little bit of difficulty with words overlapping the edge of the screen, so I'm going to go ahead and just leave this with the screen up. So, all right, can everyone hear me in the back? Am I speaking loud enough? Okay. I'm naturally soft-spoken, so please show me an ear symbol or something if I'm starting to drift back down into quiet speech. So, all right, so Pastor Ben has gone over the first 4 weeks of our Creation Science series, and this is week five, and today I'm basically going to focus on just doing a really kind of crash course, brief overview of the major components to evolutionary theory, and I'm going to attempt to talk about some of these in a way that would be people who hold this view would agree with. So trying to avoid strawmanning any of this, but I am going to point out some of the flaws along the way, and I'll repeat this a couple times over the course of this, but there is, and I somewhat divided this up in this way, there are real phenomena in nature that can be observed and tested and measured, and those are sort of the initial, that's sort of the initial fodder for people like Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, who kind of first presented Darwinian theory or evolutionary theory kind of in its first major form, what they were basing it off of. But then there are elements that are they contain elements of observable things or things that can be derived from what's observed, but they start getting into interpretation, and then there are elements to this whole system of thinking that are entirely interpretive, based completely on extrapolation or interpretation, and largely driven by presuppositions that are brought to the table. So just to introduce that kind of framework of those different categories that this is going to fall into. Yes, Mike.
Kelly, could you give us a little bit of your background in terms of your secular education and what books have informed you?
Sure. I was a music major, started grad school in music, switched over to biology, did basically the undergrad stuff to catch up, ended up getting a Master of Science in biology. I taught under the professor who taught the evolution courses. He was an excellent educator, really intelligent man. I learned a lot from him. I'm not going to go too much into that right now because of I kind of tried to put too many sardines in the stack for today. But I got somewhat timid early on with being presented with some of this content that I wasn't prepared for. More recently, I can go into some of the books that have been and resources that have been helpful at some point today or in the next couple weeks. And I'm happy to make recommendations, or I can make a little list or something like that at some point. But I've been taught all this stuff from the evolutionary perspective, and then I've kind of had to go back on my own. And there just are a lot of good resources today a lot of good work that's been done to kind of expose the fatal flaws in the system. Helpful graphic for you guys with some interactions with great 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 grandparents across the pond here. So, all right. there are multiple ways. If you look up a definition of evolution, you might see several variants of this. I use this wording because it's very specific. So we're going to just plod through this because I want you to try to keep this in mind as far as how evolutionists are defining it. And this ends up spanning those categories that I talked about before of the observable to the extrapolated. So a change in heritable characteristics of biological populations, so those would be populations that are able to interbreed across generations. So evolution is occurring at the population scale, not the individual. So individuals don't evolve, populations do. So we're talking about some kind of trait or characteristic that is inherited, that is able to be passed on across generations, and there's a change in that characteristic from one generation to another. Go ahead.
Is there a meaningful difference in the words heritable and inheritable?
You can inherit something. Heritability is just the concept of so they're based on the same word. Yeah. All right. So that phenomenon can be satisfied. That definition can be satisfied with something as uncontroversial as if you have a population of 100 dogs or something, and they're all together, or wolves or squirrels or something, and 40% of them have brown fur and 60% have black fur. And if a few generations later, now it's 30% and 70%, that's a change. If fur color is a heritable trait, that change in proportions within the same population, they're still squirrels, but the proportions of fur color, same fur colors, that would meet the definition of evolution. So that kind of foundation can lead us to think, oh, well, I guess I don't have a problem with that. But lest we think it's left there, from Charles Darwin's own words in Origins, if you kind of focus on the bold print, he's basically introducing this little section with the belief. So he's believing, so he's not proving, he's not demonstrating, he's believing that all animals and plants have descended from some one prototype. And then he kind of sort of poses the question, you know, but can analogy be a deceitful guide? Could it be wrong? You know, could I be misinterpreting? But then he kind of goes back through these lines of argument that have been convincing to him, and then concludes a little more strongly, therefore I should infer from analogy that probably all the organic beings which have ever lived on this earth, so that would be all living things, plants, animals, fungus, bacteria, have descended from some one primordial form. And then he knew that these views would come into conflict with the church. He had some nervousness before publishing, kind of sat on it for quite a while. He had a Christian upbringing, so he kind of tacks on, into which life was first breathed by the Creator. So he still attributes that first start of a primordial form to a Creator God. But so basically here he's saying we all share one common ancestor that evolved into all the diversity that we see on life in the world. So this first bracket is the set of characteristics that are basically within the realm of the observable. So basically you'll see this slide a few times. Okay, so these are, as far as this system goes, these are the conditions that have to be met, and all of them have to be met in order for evolution to take place. So if you take any one of these away, it basically the process can't occur. So we'll be quickly visiting each of these, but variation, heritability, overproduction, and selection. So variation, does anyone recognize these? Anyone familiar with our native coquina clam? So if you can see the Latin name, Donax variabilis, the cognate for variable. So good, apt specific epithet on that Latin name. So basically just the concept of there's variation. There's more than one. Not everything is identical in the population. Heritability, so just that traits can be passed down from parent to offspring. Often we see it's not just cows beget cows, but they'll oftentimes be able to pass down traits like fur color patterns or fur texture or length or things like that, what kind of milk they produce. Overproduction, this is one that isn't as immediately intuitive to some people, but in order to pick winners and losers, with some passing their DNA on more or exclusively over others, you have to have some excess individuals that can be removed from the population. Rabbits produce excess individuals. All right, I'm going to use the peppered moth as an example. This is one that's often used for the fourth pillar, that is selection. The natural coloration of the peppered moth is that light-colored individual up at the top with a kind of sprinkling of dark. But they came in two different forms. So one was the light one, that's typical coloration. The other was dark. It's a mutation that occurs across quite a number of different organisms called melanism. It basically just overproduction of melanin pretty much everywhere where pigment would be produced or could be produced. And so you end up with, you think Black Panther, same concept. Back when air quality, pre-industrial revolution, when air quality was high, lichens would grow on basically all the trees and everything where these moths would rest. And so if you were a dark individual and you rested, and you have things like birds that are predators that make their living off of eating things like moths, can you imagine what a disadvantage you would have when you're resting during the day, easily picked off by birds? But can anyone see more than one moth in that lower picture? It's not a real clear photo. You might be able to see a little bit of symmetrical head pattern here and here. Can you see that faint outline? So it fits in pretty well. Post-industrial revolution, within a few miles of industrial centers, the air quality was going down, and lichens were basically kind of the canary in the coal mine, indicator of clean air. Once the air wasn't clean, the lichens basically all died. And so now you have the trees are still alive. They can handle it. But now you have basically just dark bark everywhere. And now you look at the upper picture, and which one of these happens to blend in well? Clearly the light ones pop out very, very well. So just to kind of outline, we had variation in the population. That's satisfied. You got light and dark individuals. The coloration is a heritable trait, so light individuals have mostly light offspring. Dark individuals have mostly dark offspring. Overproduction, bless you. Overproduction. The moths produce way more caterpillars than are going to survive to adulthood. That's by design. So now we bring in what we call selection or natural selection. So I have these set up as generations. So imagine the top row is the start of that first generation post lichen all dying. The red dashes represent predation. So those individuals are removed, don't survive to reproduce. The remaining ones reproduce. And the dark individuals start increasing their proportion, their representation in the population. Generation two, same kind of phenomenon. We're down more reproduction. We're down to generation three. Now we start seeing, this is a cartoon, obviously, so you know, it might have taken more time than this, but if birds are already used to finding light moths hiding against light lichen, at some point they're going to start finding some of the dark ones because they make their living off of finding these moths and eating them. But so both are taken out, but eventually that strong selective pressure against the light moths that can't camouflage anymore leads to a change in the proportions of these heritable traits within the population. So does that all make sense as far as just this kind of observable phenomenon playing out? All right, great. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the next section. Some of these are observable, but they start including some interpretation. So we're kind of tipping a little bit into the realm of observable and interpretation for these next categories: adaptation, genetic drift, and speciation. So adaptation, the way that evolutionary biologists will use this term, they'll use it in two ways that are related. One is the process of adaptation. So essentially, a process by which something becomes better adapted to a particular environment or environmental variable. But they'll also use adaptation to refer to a trait that's adaptive to an organism's environment. So I'll give some examples, but basically, polar bear, through mutations, can easily disrupt or destroy certain processes. So leucism or albinism, basically something breaking in melanin production, that happens repeatedly. That's actually a very common mutation. If you're a bear that makes its living against a snowy background, kind of like the moth, once you start getting leucism, not albinism, because that affects eyesight and other things, but leucism, you know, basically whiteness in part of the organism, either fur or skin, that would normally produce melanin. Once you break that and it ends up being an advantage, that can end up being the dominant trait in the population. That does represent a loss of information, not new information. That's an important thing to point out. You see the same thing in bacteria once you introduce an antibiotic. If there's something in there that doesn't process that, isn't vulnerable to that antibiotic in the same way that the rest of the millions of bacteria are, that's going to basically be the thing that survives and ends up becoming the dominant strain in future generations. They do not require prior evidence of the absence of a trait to refer to something as an adaptation. That's in the examples I give, this'll make sense. But they'll use this, and it's basically like an interpretive lens, as much as it's something that also includes things that you can actually observe there or work out their origins. So examples of how it might be used: we have American alligators and American crocodiles. Alligators spend most of their time in freshwater. Crocodiles spend at least a significant amount of their time in saltwater. They have to have some way of excreting salt that gets into their system. They have lingual salt glands in their tongues, and salt will work itself out of those, and so they can maintain an osmotic balance in their body that way. Pitcher plants, they grow in nutrient-poor soils. They have modified leaves that attract insects and then hold digestive enzymes and digest them. It's a way of getting more nutrients in an otherwise nutrient-poor environment. Woodpeckers, of course, their chisel-like bill, the padding in their brain, the barbed long tongue that can skewer beetle larvae that have been exposed under the bark and extract them for food. All of those characteristics, evolutionists would refer to them as adaptations, and they imply that those all came about through the processes that we just described. So the only way those came about is through variation, mutation, selection. Basically, things given enough time, it all passed on. So these things all developed over a long period of time, and so we're going to call them adaptations. And does that make sense as far as we can use it to refer to something that we actually can observe was something that came about, but it also gets used to basically refer to any trait that we observe in living things that make them well adapted to their environment. Yes,
so
Mike.
I think what you're saying is the presupposition is if it's well adapted, it must have evolved.
Exactly. That theme will repeat itself ad infinitum.
And we just go back and forth, like longer and shorter beaks depending on what environment they're in, what kind of trees they eat food out of. That's evolution back and forth.
So yes, that they would call that evolution. So that the Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands from that first picture of Charles Darwin, that illustration, those birds with thick and thin, long and short bills, depending on food availability, which is largely dependent on weather conditions in some of those islands, they still interbreed. The different bill morphologies are retained within those populations, and the proportions change, and they would refer to, in fact, that was one of Darwin's major models he would absolutely call it that, and then we just extrapolate to get everything else. Alma, you're...
So what we're trying to explain is that the way they look at these plants that are in that week is that they were not that way, but they changed in order to be there. Instead of saying that these plants are not back there because perhaps that land has too much nutrients and will kill them, that they think that they're adapted instead of saying, no, this is exactly the way they were designed for this exact place.
Yeah, because design? Exactly. Well, we can't test that scientifically.
Exactly.
So that's not science. So we can't.
But then you have to see what are the middle ground. Where do you have proof, and how long it took for this plant that was about to die?
Yep.
In this ground, how long it took for it to figure out? Well, I can have some insects. Let me get me some weaponry for it.
Yes. Yeah. They don't need any evidence of prior evidence of the absence of that trait to use the term. So they apply it because they assume its origins.
The terminology. Plants, they don't adapt because they have to. It happens by mutation, right?
Which yes.
And they have to survive better.
Yes. Yeah, and that's a good point. So evolutionists will, at least the intellectually honest ones that are seeking to be rigorous in their presentation, they'll make it very clear that evolution is a blind process, so it doesn't have any foresight. So it's random mutations that create variation that then goes out and gets basically field tested, and the good stuff, we presume that it creates good and bad stuff, relatively speaking, and the bad stuff doesn't do as well, so the good stuff goes on. So it doesn't have a direction it's going. For these kinds of adaptations to come about, it can't be because the plants basically recognize a deficit in nutrients and are trying to come up with a response to it. It's truly random, and it just so happens that eventually leads to these traits, these characteristics. Yes, Ken. Yeah, all the favored races or superior. There's a presumption that Darwin didn't understand. We didn't know about DNA then. If we didn't know about DNA, we couldn't know about mutations. So they didn't understand any of the how heritability works. They knew there was variation. They knew that sometimes that was relatively advantageous or disadvantageous. And so there was a presumption that it had to come from somewhere. And so before we understood the complexity of the cell and all of this kind of stuff, you could imagine that these little structures that make up a living organism just somehow they ended up being different things at different times, and so there must be some way of changing. So it was much more cartoonish. It was almost like we're all kind of at the micro scale. We're all kind of made out of kind of magical Play-Doh blobs, and you can make different things out of that. Yeah. Yes, Ken.
So was it his intent to contradict the creation story, or was he just trying to explain what he was observing?
That's a good question. I mean, biographers have written a whole bunch of stuff about him, and I have not done a deep dive on Charles Darwin or Alfred Russel Wallace, who's the other one who is kind of simultaneously kind of taking a lot of the elements that had already been put on the table by people before them, but they were kind of the two that are, with Darwin being the most familiar name in households, but who basically collected those ideas and first kind of had them ready to publish. I'm not sure what motivated him, but I know he knew there was going to be a conflict. He knew it was going to be controversial. Most people don't choose difficult paths because they want life to be difficult. So there's probably some degree of intellectual honesty there, making observations and just coming to wrong conclusions. Probably had to do with his influences. This has been used powerfully to undermine the biblical account for many people in the last couple centuries. So, you know, any of us can become pawns of the evil one. And so regardless of his motivations, that's, you know, basically he attributes, you know, something still origins to a creator at the beginning, even with his fully extrapolated universal common descent of all living things. But all, you know, that was one little flick away from, okay, well, we'll flick the creator off the end of that, and now we have a system that can kind of permit us to try to explain everything with no God to have to be accountable to. So anyway, that's not a satisfying answer, Ken, but it is interesting to think about motivations, but I would only be speculating. All right, Trevor.
So, in Origin of Species, Darwin references God like two or three times. The first in a prologue of sorts where he cites Bacon in Management of Learning, and I think it goes towards Ken's question.
Yeah.
You'll allow me to read it right quick.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Bacon says, Charles Darwin is quoting, "To conclude, therefore, let no man out of a weak conceit of sobriety or an ill-applied moderation think or even maintain that a man can search too far or be too well studied in the book of God's word or in the book of God's work, divinity or philosophy, but rather let men endeavor an endless progress or proficiency in both." So, and then I read the other places where it references God and his works, and I don't think it's in any malicious intent to subvert. I think that happened after.
Mm-hmm.
We see that subversion greatly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that was his intent, at
mm-hmm.
least in that work.
Yeah, thank you for reading that, Trevor. Okay, so I'm going to go through this. Genetic drift, this is actually observable. This isn't used as a required pillar of the theory. It's not one of the big extrapolations. This is essentially just one of the mechanisms for change in proportions of genetic traits within a population. So we talked about selection. That's considered sort of the driving force. Genetic drift is something that's observable. It is something that happens, particularly with near-neutral traits, which I'm not going to go way into that right now. But basically, because it's random, it's the shifts that happen randomly. It's much more of a factor with very small population sizes. So if you can imagine flipping a coin, you could flip a coin two or three times and maybe still get all heads or maybe get all tails. But once you start flipping a coin like 100 times or 1,000 times, your distribution is going to start approaching almost exactly 50-50. Unless you have a trick coin that's meant to cheat or something.
So, crocodiles and alligators, if there's freshwater, saltwater, if you said crocs were saltwater, if they were to spend, say, half their time in freshwater, half their time in saltwater, they would develop smaller salt glands, the excretion glands. So rather than having like some common ancestor 10,000 years ago or whatever people say, it's more likely that there's something that's sort of in between the two that exists now, or is it strictly those two species and they're separate, clearly defined?
Yeah, they'll overlap. You can find an alligator and a crocodile in the same location sometimes, but the center of gravity of the crocodiles is in a brackish or saltwater system, and then alligators is freshwater and with occasional exposure to brackish or saltwater. Yeah, Mike.
So the word population, I suppose that biologists study statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a variation within any population.
Yeah.
So when you look at trying to compare a separate population, say it's distinct, the founder population from the originating population,
mm-hmm.
are they using this 95% confidence, or are they dropping it down?
That's a good question. It probably just depends on what the editors will accept. But my point in illustrating this right here is basically just to, if you can imagine a little population of beetles or something there are a few individuals that may not be very representative of the originating population. They're in a dead tree. The dead tree falls into the water in a storm, floats over and lands on a little island somewhere that doesn't have these beetles. When those reproduce, the proportions of traits, heritable characteristics, may be quite different than the originating population because of the little shifts, either because you didn't get a representative sample in the first place. Even if you did, though, even if it was a perfect capturing of the whole in variation within that population, because the numbers are small in the founding population, random chance alone in the early generations could tip it in a different direction, even if there was no obvious selective advantage on that new island. And then if they populate that whole island, that population might be different because of that genetic drift early on when the population was small.
So my question boils around the unity and diversity of a population.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything is exactly the same in the original population.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yes.
So whether we're talking about how dialects change from town to town,
mm-hmm.
or maybe the color of a beetle, so eventually where we're going to go is how do you jump from species to a new species?
Right.
So I'm having trouble with the micro analysis.
Yes.
Being something that you can call evolution as to just a variation in that original population.
Right. Yes. And just natural fluctuations. That's a good point. And some of that gets into definitions. Some of it gets into philosophical approach, what we think is beneficial. Are we seeding ground by using their terminology? Are we removing a distraction when we're talking to certain people in order to carry on a conversation? It might take some discernment, and it might depend on who we're talking to. Okay, so to Mike's point about speciation, these are all currently, as far as I understand, considered part of the same species complex, so all one species of Encetina Escholdii. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but Basically, these occupy somewhat different habitat types, and there's limited genetic flow across this whole species range. And if you see the kind of bluish-purple color that comes and looks like it meets the green there, mm-hmm. there's actually a barrier there. They can't interact across that fine line there. So you have some long lobes of distribution of some of these populations that are not having much exchange anymore. And the slightly different conditions, different plant communities across valleys from each other have either through genetic drift, just random kind of shifts into different color patterns or relative dryness tolerance or things like that, maybe different predator types, have kind of pushed them into different kind of different color patterns. They're all basically the same. They're the same organism. They all basically, if you know how to find them in one part and you went to another area, you could pretty easily adjust to figuring out they're occupying the same kind of ecological niche. But they've kind of developed these different color patterns. This is often used as an example of a species that is in the process of speciating. So they expect that what we're seeing here is we're seeing speciation happening, but it's not fully happened yet. One of the big issues with the term species is how do you define it? So there are different species concepts, and there is not universal. There's never been universal agreement in the definition of a species. So Adam in the garden was told to name the animals. He was recognizing differences, and he gave them names. We know that not everything is the same. So there's something real that we're trying to get at, but at some point, when we try to draw a hard line, it's actually not super clear. So how many of you have heard the term biological species concept? Is that familiar? Surprisingly, my family has. Yes, Alma.
The way I understood it was that species can reproduce among each other.
Yes.
But once you get them mixed, if you have an elephant and a dog or what have you, they will not be able to reproduce.
That is true.
So that means they're two different.
Never species. Tested that, but that's true.
There are examples for that as well. So it's
kind of black and white. For sure. So the biological species concept, it's basically what Alma was saying. And you guys can probably think of some examples, Liger or something, where there's an offspring that's possible, but it's not viable offspring, so it can't reproduce to successive generations.
A mule
is another great example. So the biological species concept would basically be, can things interbreed and then those things in turn can continue breeding. A very, very, very small percentage of the roughly 1.5 million species, I might be wrong about that number, but of all the species of bacteria and fungi and plants and fish and other animals and all kinds of stuff that have been described, a very, very, very small percentage of them have been based on the biological species concept. Almost all of them have been based on a morphological species concept, which is basically what Adam did. These look different. I found this thing that looks different. I'm going to call it this. No one has any idea what they can breed with or anything like that. And actually, some of the plants and some other things can interbreed with wildly different things that if you mix their pollen and stuff like that. And can create bizarre forms and stuff, and people have played with that in horticulture and in agricultural purposes. Basically most species are described based on they just look different. And then the more recent one is basically based on genetics. And that gets into really, it gets very arbitrary, how we set our standards, what we're basing it on. Are we just looking at the mitochondria, or are we looking at full gene sequencing, which it takes a lot more time and money? And so basically academics are setting thresholds and then meeting the threshold, and then they can split a species into more than one, even though they all look exactly the same and they can interbreed and all this kind of stuff. But it gets them more papers, which gets them credit in their department, and helps them reach tenure, money, all that kind of stuff. So, yes, Andrew?
If you were to take an example like a liver enzyme, if I had a high count of a liver enzyme that broke down a particular pharmaceutical drug, and he had a much lower one, is that just us humans being different, or is that genetic drift as well? Because it's a mutation in the gene sequence.
So you have, if it's heritable, then it can be passed on, but our DNA, we basically have two copies of DNA that get recombined and passed on. So you could pass it on, you might not pass it on. There's also a whole thing of epigenetics that it can changes, and some of this goes kind of far afield, but
I can talk to you about it later.
Yeah, sure. So anyway, speciation, do things change? Sure. But these are all still salamanders. And so far they can still breed. So, all right, now to the extrapolation part, and I'm realizing I'm kind of running low on time. This isn't just mutations. Mutations happen. Mutations are happening all the time. We'll get more into that next week. The statement here is mutations are the source of variation in all living things. Time as vast amounts of time. Common ancestry, universal common ancestry, like we talked about before. So this is basically a cartoon of the process of mutation. Start out with generation at the top, and now imagine mutations lead to three different variants of a trait in a population. One is disadvantageous. It gets filtered out. The other two start reproducing, go on. And at different points, you start seeing, you know, eventually you have white, light gray, medium gray, and dark gray. Some of those are pretty similar. And so from the top one, light gray, to the bottom, you no longer have light gray, but you've gone from one variant to two, and you've actually had multiple other ones come in and get filtered out. So there's this kind of assumption that we're increasing the diversity of life forms. More things are, there are beneficial ones and detrimental ones coming into being and then fading back out, and eventually you end up with this net increase in variation and life forms and everything. That's the cartoon picture of this process that is presumed to happen. And this isn't just a mutation in a gene that's a copy error that leads to basically a flaw. There's this presumption that it's creating useful genetic information that actually codes for useful traits or characteristics. Yes, Trevor?
And this is how NOAA fit all animals onto the ark, right? Because you just did the light blue one at the top. You didn't have to cover all the bases down at the bottom.
I'd like to explore that probably in week three. But yes, God designed DNA to be, and multiple copies that we retain, to actually carry a lot more information than actually gets expressed in each individual. And so actually that's absolutely an important principle. Trevor was basically just saying, if anyone didn't hear it, NOAA could fit a lot of, he didn't have to get every variant onto the ark. He could basically load individuals on the ark that then still contained a lot of genetic coding for variability of traits that then, as they started recombining genetically with their offspring, could then end up taking different forms and occupying the newly available ecological niches around the planet. Yes?
In your diagram before that, at what point, say, in the animal kingdom, are we talking about different numbers of chromosomes? Are we talking within a certain, are we just talking variations in the plant within a chromosomal?
The presumption is that the original life form didn't have multiple copies. It had to be something incredibly simple. So even our ability to have multiple chromosomes would be something that would be presumed to develop later. And I am not an expert at genetics or anything, but they'll point to things like triploid and tetraploid organisms that basically end up carrying extra, you can have basically gray tree frogs and Cope's gray tree frogs. One of them is basically diploid, so it has two chromosomes. The Cope's gray, I think it might be tetraploid, but it's basically they're doubled, and now they all carry it, and so that came about by mutation. Their song is a little bit different, but they basically look the same. So they'll point to things like that as explanations for, and so they just think every characteristic that we can observe, it must have come about by evolution. So, all right, time. You guys are familiar with this. Just if these things all came about by natural random processes, then it must have taken vast amounts of time. So these are some estimates that you can find. Nearly 14 billion years for the Earth or the universe, and 3.5 or 4 billion years of life coming into being to what we see today. Common ancestry, basically, I'm trying to hurry up here. It would be such an extraordinary thing for life to come into being from non-life without a creator that we need to make sure we're not demanding that it happen more than once. So we assume it happened once, and then basically because we share all these things, there's similarities in living forms and what we're built out of, there's just this presumption that we all came from the same thing. And if you extrapolate processes out on the tips of these trees, if you extrapolate, go far enough back, then we all have shared common ancestry. All right, so some of the lines of evidence, I'm just going to flip through. So the pattern, deep to shallow, simple to complex, is what they'll say. And there are consistent patterns in what, if you go look in, it's not like we start finding major exceptions to this. There are fairly consistent patterns in the fossil record. And everyone agrees that the bottom layer was deposited before the top layers. So is the term uniformitarianism a familiar term to any of you? Basically, the assumption that how we see things happening today, that it's valid to assume that's how things have always occurred. So if we see a very slow, gradual accumulation of soil or things like that, maybe little local flood events that put a little spread of substrate down, then we can kind of extrapolate based on that this must have taken a tremendous amount of time to lay down all these layers. So that's basically things have always worked uniformly. The contrast to that maybe some of you are familiar with is catastrophism. And that's basically the idea that something like a huge global flood or other, global catastrophes could have changed the way the atmosphere is, couldn't lay down tremendous amounts of sediment very rapidly, and that can explain what we're observing in the fossil record. So, all right. So, just a few counterpoints. Basically, people who understand how fossilization works, probably a lot of you know what happens. If a deer gets hit on the side of the road, and then is in the ditch or someone drags it off into the woods, what's the likelihood that that's going to become a fossil? Yeah, zero. Even the bones are useful for animals to gnaw on for calcium and things like that. It'll go away completely. And yet we have incredibly well-preserved fossils, even with skin and fur and scales and feathers, kind of level detail and a lot of this stuff. So these were buried very rapidly, and then we have basically very in mineral composition and animal the types of organisms that are in the fossil layers. We have corresponding layers across multiple continents that that have the same. They're basically the same layer, and so if these were just local processes happening, how can you just? There's really no good explanation for why that would be that kind of global pattern. There are also organisms buried in layers that are supposedly tens of millions of years old. Basically that's when those things lived, and then after that we don't see them again because they went extinct. But then people find them today. So, like the coelacanth, if anyone knows what that is, a lobe-finned fish. It's a popular one to refer to as the thing that crawled out onto the land and started developing terrestrial limbs. They supposedly went extinct 65 million years ago, according to the fossil record. Never showed up again, but people are catching them off the African coast or whatever. So they're alive. There's a pine that supposedly blinked out 150 million years ago, and until botanists found a population of them extant somewhere in the world. So there are some problems with the interpretation that this is basically a historical record of living things. I'm going to make a little plug. Kurt Wise did a flood, geophysics of the flood. I can send you guys that link at some point if you're interested. I'm gonna move on. There are other points that could be made, but this is not a watertight line of argument. So homologies. Just this is another example of terminology. So. Because we can find these corresponding bone structures across multiple organisms that we consider to be closely related, you know, taxonomically, mammals, that's a category. Humans are mammalian in our physiology. So people will say, well, if these multiple different types of mammals have corresponding bone structures, then they probably, the most likely explanation is they all share a common ancestor that had a humerus, a radius, an ulna, you know, metacarpals, phalanges, all that kind of stuff. And as those traits, as those lineages basically diverge from each other, the relative shape and function of those structures, those same structures, you know, shifted in those different lineages, but they all point to a shared common ancestor and can be explained by divergence from a common ancestor, as opposed to a common designer out of whose mind these things were designed. So this is completely, no one can go back and point to, you know, basically piece back together the kind of transitional forms going back to the origin, but it's presumed. So this is all interpretive. The counterpart to homologies would be analogies, and instead of divergence, this would be considered an example of convergence, where traits, similar functioning structures develop from things that are not presumed to be closely related. So just a terminology point. Okay, another line of evidence is biogeography. Basically, if we assume new traits or new life forms evolved and then radiated out from there. Essentially, this is the kind of distribution we do often see on the planet. So this is for the sirens. We happen to be in basically the siren mecca of its worldwide distribution. We have basically the highest concentration of different siren species in our area, but they inhabit murky, swampy waters and stuff like that, so most people never see one. So the top four are the siren species that we have on Eglin, and then that young greater siren that I'm holding there from a number of years ago is just east of Eglin. Yes, Andrew?
That's you.
Yes, that's me.
A little different without a beard.
Yeah, pre-COVID beard. but what you'll notice here is, I forget who made the point, but about maybe it was Trevor, about Noah takes something on an ark, releases it into the new, you know, world, basically, and there's enough variation still in the genome that it can basically diversify, recombine, take on different forms, occupy different ecological niches, and be under selective pressure. So some of these processes that we're talking about with existing variation that God wrote into the genome can basically lead to these things. But all of these have in common, they're all aquatics, exclusively aquatic salamanders. They all have front limbs, but no hind limbs. They all have bushy external gills. They're all sirens. They're all basically the same body form, but they have some different markings, different sizes, and we could even say different adaptations to fit their various kind of specific habitats that they mostly live in. All right, this last one, ontogeny does not recapitulate phylogeny. This is one that was held, and modern evolutionists do not hold to this. They won't actually say this, but there's still enough of them that will make references to this basically that if you look at our early embryonic stage, that upper right handmost one, that is, it looks a lot like other vertebrate embryos. And people will say, well, look at our gill slits. It's referencing, you know, kind of a fish-like ancestor. And then the tail is sort of like a reptilian tail. And we're, you know, our embryology basically recapitulates the different primitive life forms that we used to be. And that's rejected. All those, the gill slits basically just form our sinuses and our jaw structure and things like that. The tail... it all just develops into our vertebrae and our coccyx at the tip of our vertebrae. So it's not held to. Another similar thing that people will sometimes say is, "You dumb creationists! Like, you're trying to say this is so far fetched that we could have evolved from a single celled organism. We start as a single celled organism." But the difference is, a single-celled organism actually is able to operate and function in its environment and reproduce as a single cell. When we're a single cell, we have to be in our womb and in our mother's womb and be kept under all these, and we have the blueprints for a fully mature human. And there are no instructions for how to function as this tiny little zygote, fertilized egg. So it's sort of it sounds almost plausible until you start thinking about it, and then it becomes absurd. So
exact ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny was taught at LSU Medical School from about 1910 to maybe into the 50s.
Okay.
Exact thing. My father, a doctor who graduated from there, had that as his primary reason to not. not believe in creating.
Wow.
Is ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Yeah.
It's taught at LSU. It's got to be right.
It's got to be. Yeah. So they're constantly, I mean, they've been constantly shifting and rejecting things, but, oh, yeah, but, and, you know, so they've shifted their positions as the evolutionists over the years, but the evolutionary theorists are constantly, they're at odds with the practitioners, you know, the academics who are teaching all this, the next round of, next cohort of students graduating.
So evolutionists are great variation.
Oh, yeah. Over time and, oh, yeah. And it all came about by random chance.
Sure.
Okay, I'm basically out of time. Basically, genetic evidence, essentially, just imagine there are some areas of the genome that accumulate mutations more easily than without them getting filtered out of the population than others. So things that are synonymous, you know, something where it still codes for the same protein, something like that. And people will look at chimps and humans, for example, and say, look, we have all kinds of non-synonymous genes in common, but the synonymous ones, they've accumulated different mutations. It, you know, that shows divergence. But it's, if God created those forms and we can observe the parts of the genome that accumulate mutations more readily without consequence, it's the same exact pattern that we would expect to see if we were specially created, as if we diverged from a common ancestor. So they'll make a lot of arguments like that. Another is the assumption that a lot of the DNA was junk DNA, which the percentage that is considered junk DNA just keeps going down the more people learn about DNA. So vestigial structures, this is a salamander, its eyes don't work. It can't form images anymore, but people will point to what's left of the eye, a vestigial eye, and say, this had a common ancestor with an eye. Yes, it did. It was a salamander. It lost function. So there's not a gain of information. There's a loss of information, functional information. But they'll also point to things like these floating kind of pelvic bones in a whale and say, to be vestigial, by definition, is basically to mean it's lost all or most of its original function. And they'll point to this and say, see, this is an animal that it had a pelvis. Its ancestors had a pelvis. That means it had hind limbs. But this doesn't. It isn't a non-functional structure. It serves as super important, necessary points of attachment for tendons, for the various abdominal muscles that are used in motion and reproduction and all kinds of things. So, same with our tailbone, the coccyx. Basically, oh, that's a vestige of, and people publish in Nature because these prestigious journals, they have an ideology, and so they'll, you know, oh yeah, we publish in there. Well, it must be true, you know. We had tails. We had ancestors with tails. Well, that bone structure helps support the floor of the floor of the. Basically the pelvic floor, without some of the points of attachment that rely on that, we basically couldn't control our bowels. There are absolutely essential biological functions that rely on that little bone being right there, and not being fused with the sacrum, having a little bit of movement in order to basically give birth and things like that. So just this, these are, when these terms are applied, they're being applied through an extrapolated presuppositional lens. I was just going to point out some actual concrete disagreement with Scripture. Basically, age of the earth, the order of creation, special creation versus random mutation, and then a big one is basically death entering the world before sin. Caleb put these on the church website, so please feel free to look at some of these. I'm basically, I'm out of time, so I need to stop. But this is a preview of where we're going to be going, is essentially with all of this, one of the most vulnerable, fatal flaws to this whole theoretical system is this idea of mutations and selection, random mutations being the author of all genetic information, because it is an incredibly complex information system. And if this, if you remove this, the whole, it's like removing the keystone from an old arch, the whole system, the whole extrapolated system, basically crumbles. It's dead on arrival. It cannot work. So all these other things that are kind of viewed through this lens and are propped up against this system to reinforce it from other scientific disciplines, you're going to have to come up with some other explanation for it, because the whole thing is completely fatally flawed. And we'll get into some of that, a couple angles of that next week. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience. And I didn't leave any time for questions today, but I'll be happy to talk with anyone at a different time. So Ben, do you usually close in prayer? Would you?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Father, we bless you for this class and for being able to learn and think together. I pray that even with some of the technical material, we would, through these things, make us sharper and more faithful worshipers, lovers of God, and lovers of our neighbor. And now, Lord, as we approach you in worship, bless and enable them.
Amen. Thank you, Ben. Thank you all.